This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today's guest, Dennis Leary, has come a long way since chain-smoking his way through his corrosive comedy shorts on MTV. He starred in a number of film comedies and dramas. He's co-creator, executive producer, co-writer, and star of the FX series Rescue Me. And just last weekend, he was seen as one of Al Gore's chief campaign advisors in HBO's Recount, a very good recounting of the hotly contested 2000 presidential election. Here's Leary telling another campaign chief, played by Kevin Spacey, that they have to be more aggressive in the effort to tally uncounted votes.
Listen, there's a giant scoreboard out there somewhere. We can't play a gentleman's game here or we're going to lose. Whoever has the ball when the clock runs out is going to be declared the winner.
Gore wants to win as much as you do. He just doesn't want to set the Constitution on fire to do it.
Okay, well, right now we're down by less than 2,000 votes. Meanwhile, there's 175,000 ballots out there that the count machines have declared non-votes, okay? So that's 175,000 uncounted ballots.
How does a thing like that even happen?
Because punch card ballots are okay, they're primitive. You got cardboard chad that get punched but don't go all the way through the hole, so they're hanging off the edge of the ballot.
Hanging chads.
Chad.
What?
There's no S.
The plural of chad is chad?
That's great democracy.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Rescue Me is Dennis Leary's main showcase these days, but you have to know when and where to find it. The DVD box set of season 4 comes out next week. And 5-minute mini-sodes of fresh, standalone Rescue Me material will appear this summer. But season 5 of Rescue Me, with actual 1-hour episodes, has been delayed by the writer's strike and won't begin on the FX network until April 2009. In Rescue Me, Leary plays Tommy Gavin, a New York City firefighter constantly risking his life to save others. But when it comes to his friends and family, he's constantly letting them down. He drinks too much, cheats too much, lies when he thinks he needs to, and gets into fights. At the start of season 4, his personal life, as usual, is in shambles. He's been separated from his wife Janet, but he's just moved back in with her and the baby, which may or may not be his. And he's just caught their teenage daughter Colleen coming in from a date with her boyfriend at 3 in the morning, not only drunk, but smelling of marijuana. In this scene, he's talking with his wife about it. By the way, this scene includes some brief, crude language, but all of it is language that sounds convincingly, compellingly real.
Colleen is smoking pot.
I know.
You know? What do you mean you know?
Yeah, and it's a good pot, too, not the cheap we used to get.
Great. That's a great attitude. You know, I told you years ago pot's a gateway drug. So tonight she comes home, not only is she high, she's drunk.
What?
Drunk, yeah. Face puked, yeah.
Was she driving?
No, I think her 50-year-old boyfriend was handling the driving responsibilities.
He's 26. And that's good.
Why is that good?
Because he doesn't drink.
Okay, but I'm pretty sure that she's banging this guy. Yeah.
I know. Look, she's on the pill.
You put her on the pill? Is it insane? You got the whole toolbox going. Booze, penises. I mean, I can't believe that I'm finally the moral compass in this family. I mean,
Yeah, right.
You're an enabler. That's what you are. Yeah. Yeah.
Shh.
When were you planning on telling me about this?
Well, I was going to drop the sex bomb on you a while ago, but then this whole platonic living arrangement thing has been going so well.
Yeah.
You know, and then you always take the word sex as an invitation, so I didn't want to risk it. And as for the pot and booze, well, check her birth certificate. The last name's Gavin.
Dennis Leary, welcome back to Fresh Air. Rescue Me was inspired by a couple of firefighters you were close to. Would you tell us something about them?
One is the technical advisor to Rescue Me, an old friend of mine named Terry Quinn, who's been a New York City firefighter for 20-some-odd years now. And he is one of my oldest friends, and because he's still a working firefighter and much like Tommy Gavin, has no interest in becoming an officer or anything other than a truck guy, which means the guys who actually, you know, run off into the fire, you know, when they jump off the rig at an event. He's an action guy. So he's also our technical advisor in charge of all of our big fire scenes. And the other guy, who shall remain nameless, who's a good friend of mine as well, I just saw him last night. We had the premiere here in New York, and whenever I see him, whatever he's talking about in terms of his personal life becomes fodder for the upcoming episodes of Rescue Me, because he lives such a rich and interesting life. Then two of those guys combined are who Tommy Gavin is. And he, again, is just a firefighter who's been in a very busy house, you know, for 20-some-odd years and has no plans on leaving or retiring, or he's just lives and dies to fight fires.
You have a cousin who was killed in a fire.
Yeah.
And do you think he ever thought that that would happen to him?
He used to say, when his wife or his mother or anybody would say, you know, what are we going to do if something happens to you? Because he was considered a quote-unquote fireman's fireman. Like he was the first guy in. The night that he died, he was filling in for a guy who had done a favor for him, and he was supposed to be driving the truck, but he hated staying with the truck while guys went into a fire. So he traded off with another guy who said, you know, I don't want to sit with the truck if something happens tonight. I want to be in the building. So he wasn't supposed to be working that night, and he wasn't supposed to be actually going into the building, but he was because that's where he wanted to be. He was looking for two homeless people. He used to say, you guys are just going to have to deal with it if I get killed. See, the amazing part of that story with my cousin is not just that he went into a burning, you know, inferno of a cold storage warehouse building that the windows had been bricked up. He went in looking for two homeless people. He got trapped with another guy. And the kid that I grew up with, that we grew up with, named Tommy Spencer, who was outside when they closed the building down. The chief said, nobody else is going in. It's too big. It was shutting the building down. Tommy Spencer tied three other guys to himself, and he walked up to the chief who was blocking the doorway and said, get out of the way or I'll knock you down. I'm going in to get Paul and Jerry. And they went in, and within, you know, minutes, the building went up a second time. That is an amazing amount of courage, and the sense of brotherhood, and just to begin with, the sense of brotherhood towards your fellow man, two homeless people that you don't even know, and then the sense of, well, we know this is probably not going to work, but we have to make that last stand to see if we can get those guys out.
I'd imagine that, you know, starring and doing some of the writing and, of course, also producing the series Rescue Me has you thinking a lot about death and about kind of self-destructive impulses, because like your character, Tommy, he deals with life and death every day in putting himself in life-threatening situations to rescue people. At the same time, he flirts with death through smoking and alcohol and really stupid risks he takes in his personal life.
Yeah. Yeah, I think part of the attraction to writing these guys was the male ego as it exists in almost every man. And then the male ego as required for the type of courage that this job takes. One of the things that the male ego does when mortality bumps up against it is you want to have sex. You want to prove, I'm vital, I'm alive. Look at me, I'm alive. And these guys are living this crazy job that has everything to do with life and death, but nothing to do with life as we know it, love, death, and taxes, you know, the way we look at it. So that's where I find it to be very rich, and it never ceases to amaze me, the stories. Like a buddy of mine told me a story today. He was a firefighter. He was at work. He got a phone call from his brother, and his brother said, I got some bad news. And he said, what is it? He said, Dad died. He said, when? Like about 5 minutes ago. And he said, all right. And he went back into the bunk room. He fell asleep. The alarm went off an hour later. He went to a fire. He never dealt with his father's death because he dealt with death. And then one day he was reading Flags of Our Fathers last year, and he collapsed for 2 days and basically couldn't stop crying. You know, 10 years after his father had died, because he's so afraid of letting the other emotions about the girl that he didn't save here, the guys that came out of 9/11 like him, and the guys who didn't, guys that he knew and loved, and so many emotions that they're like, you have to be an animal, you have to be like a shark, you have to keep moving forward. Yeah, everything's behind me, everything's behind me, everything's behind me. That's an interesting story. I mean, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to Tommy Gavin when he stops moving?
Yeah, here's this character who's really attracted to extremes, you know, so like, you know, rescuing people and fighting fires and stuff, but those extremes don't match in, say, being life as a spouse or as a father, and he has real trouble in those areas.
Yeah, and most of the guys that I know, even the guys that this character's based on, have those same issues. But you know what? if you asked them, if you cornered them, you wouldn't even have to corner them. You could just ask them. They'll say that's what makes them a great firefighter. One of the things they talk about, women compartmentalizing emotions and approaches and how they live. And that's one of the things about, like, even my cousin, Jerry, he knew that there was a chance every time he was, you know, at work that he wasn't going to come back. And he was okay with that, even though he loved his kids and his wife. And his wife understood when she met him that that's what he wanted to be. He knew that was a box in his head, that this is always a possibility and it doesn't matter. I still will take the chance. It's like rolling the dice, you know?
In some ways, you are the, you know, actor, comic, writer who has taken on, like, the male ego out of control as your subject. You know, mm-hmm. it was kind of that as a comic, know, in some of like, your rants and in some of your movie characters, but certainly in, you know, in your character in Rescue Me. And I guess I'm interested in finding out why that's your territory, why you're so interested in, like, male ego out of control.
I don't know. I think as a comedian, I hope I had enough of a tongue in my cheek sometimes so that people knew I wasn't just taking the piss out of individual politicians or pop culture icons or attitudes that I found pretentious, but also a little bit out of that macho thing. You know, in No Cure for Cancer, I talked a lot about my father and the John Wayne, we don't go to the hospital even though we might have cut our own fingers off with a saw mentality. And, you know, and how the sons of that generation of men were supposed to deal with being a man. I guess because I am a man, I find that territory interesting. But as a comedian, I love to hit. I mean, for instance, you know, I do like 4 or 5 gigs every fall. I don't have that much time to go on tour now with Rescue Me, but I do a couple of charity gigs as a stand-up, and I do the New York Comedy Festival every year. And I refuse to do anything that's material I've done before. So I don't write all my jokes. I don't write jokes. I have bullet points, and I just improvise. So when I saw Mel Gibson's thing happen, where he got arrested and said those anti-Semitic remarks, I had 10 minutes of material automatically from that. When I saw the enumeration of things that Paul McCartney supposedly did to Heather Mills McCartney, I immediately started practicing hopping around on one leg because she said Paul would force her to go to the bathroom instead of using a bedpan. I mean, I get up and I had 10 minutes of material about how difficult it is to be a one-legged woman married to a beetle. That's... You know, I just go by what I find funny. And it relates to why firefighters became available to me in the show is funny and heartbreaking is because in the kitchen in the firehouse, there's a lot of black humor because that's how they avoid the real emotions and get around the corner, you know, from what they just saw. And I relate to that. And I relate to sort of... I guess, you know, as they say in Ireland, taking the piss out of whatever the subject might be, you know.
Dennis Leary, speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2007 interview with actor, writer, producer Dennis Leary. Season 4 of his FX series, Rescue Me, comes out next week on DVD.
So talk a little bit about shooting the fire sequences on Rescue Me, where, I mean, there's sequences where, you know, where you or other characters are surrounded by, a wall or two of fire, and we're falling through buildings and so on. So, like, every week there must be a lot of, serious special effects you have to...
There's a lot of special effects. What we've done this year, which I'm... you've probably seen the first...
Three episodes.
The first evidence is in the first episode where there's just that one long take with no edits where we walk into the building and into a room, and then the room catches on fire, and then the building basically explodes, and there's no stuntmen in that scene, and there's no cuts until the floor collapses. And that's the beginning of this upping the ante that we did this year. As the season goes on, there are longer sequences. Some are 4, some are 5, some are 7 minutes long where we go into a call. There's no editing, and the camera follows us into the building, and the fire explodes, and the action continues and there are no stuntmen. It's the real actors, and it's really very difficult to shoot, but it's fabulously, I hope, entertaining and on the edge of the seat for the audience, because we wanted to make it more, even more realistic than we've done before, about how it feels for these guys when they go in.
Well, in the scene that you're describing, you know, three or so of the guys, including you, basically are, it's as if you're like sliding down a chute right into the fire,
right into
a wall of fire when the floor collapses beneath you. So what exactly are you being shooted into?
In the original take, the floor actually, we rigged the floor in the building to go up, and we slid down onto pads, which is still pretty scary because it's a three-story drop, and you know, all the things in the room go first, and then the actors come afterwards. So it is a little dangerous. And then in the special effect department, we slid down that just as high into green screen with pads. But we've just finished shooting a maze fire that took, it was 5.5 minutes long from beginning to end, in which the fire escalates as we go through, and there's no cuts, there's no stuntmen, and the special effects are happening within the scene. And it was scary as hell, but it looks great on camera. You know, basically what we do when I do those scenes is we come up with an idea, and I say to Terry Quinn, you know, we're not even going to write the dialogue. You tell us what we should be saying and what the radio calls should be. And then Terry designs it, you know, because he's still a working firefighter. One time last year we had a bus fire. I called him up and I said, Peter and Evan and I are thinking of doing a bus fire. And he said, I'll call you right back. I'm at a bus fire right now. And he called us back and he said, all right, here's what we just did. So I love when you're watching something and you realize, my God, there's no, this is the scene that just started. There's no cuts here. Like that movie Children of Men that was out last year. There were a couple of sequences where I went, oh my God, that's Julianne Moore. There's no cuts here. They're, you know, and you can't even breathe. You're so taken in by what you're watching.
Now, you were roommates with Mario Cantone at Emerson College or classmates?
Well, no, I wasn't actually his roommate, but we were in the
same class.
Theater group together.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And his roommate for a brief time was Gina Gershon, who was younger than us, but by happenstance ended up sort of being Mario's roommate. And for Mario's family, his supposed girlfriend, you know, even though,
right.
You know, Mario, I mean, from the first time I met Mario, there was no question, you know, we went to Emerson College, which is a fabulous college creatively. And, you know, there were three women to every man and two out of every three guys was gay. So it was, but his parents ran a nightclub / restaurant and his brothers used to work the door, a very tough Italian family. And, you know, it used to be funny. We'd go in there and Mario never pretended to be anybody but who he is. And his brothers would go, that Mario, he's so creative, right? And we'd be like, oh, yeah, he's real creative. He's real creative. You know, that Gina boy, she's pretty. Yeah, she's pretty. Yep. So he was, I tell you, there was a very talented group of people at that school. And out of all of them, myself included, nobody was funnier than Mario Cantone.
Well, it amuses me to think of you as being friends because your onstage character or, you know, like the Tommy character tends to be kind of like homophobic, but obviously you and Mario Cantone, who's very gay and very out, were good friends. So obviously you're not like...
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I don't think Mario, by the way, was ever in. There was never any closets in any building that Mario lived in. No, of course not. I think that's some. It's like when people throw the misogynistic label at Rescue Me, and Peter and I sort of rankle under that because...
As your co-producer.
You know, and my co-writer, Peter Tolan, because, you know, we always say, well, I guess you should ask Susan Sarandon and Marissa and Gina, you know, how they feel about that, because we get these great actresses to play these roles. You know, it's contained within the element. It's very organic to the element of the show that firefighters are... considered homophobic, or that they don't want a gay firefighter in their midst. But ultimately, it really doesn't matter. There's a gay chief in the FDNY who's one of the most noted firefighters who ever put on his bunker gear because he was a terrific firefighter. And as a very young chief now, is looked up to as, you know, a guy that the guys really trust. Ultimately, they don't care. They really just want to make sure that you can do the job and that you've got their back. And that's really what they care about in the end. You know, in the newspapers or in the media when they start saying the FDNY is, you know, racially unbalanced and prejudiced. And the truth is, it's like playing in the NFL. Can you block that guy? You want to play middle linebacker? You got to be able to block the guy. So that's all they care about. And the greatest answer to the idea that they might be prejudiced racially is, do you think they actually consider the color of the people in the building before they go in and get them? You know, Tommy Gavin says in one episode this year, he goes, I'd have to go back and count how many Hispanic, fat, ugly, black, yellow, green people I've saved over the 20 years I've been in this department, because I didn't keep track, because all I wanted was to get whoever it was out. And I think that's the answer to the racial question in the FDNY, is they don't care. They don't really care.
Dennis Leary, speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. The fourth season of Rescue Me comes out on DVD next week. More of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's 2007 interview with comic, writer, and actor Dennis Leary. He co-starred last week in the HBO telemovie Recount, and he's the co-creator, executive producer, co-writer, and star of the FX cable series Rescue Me. Because of the writer's strike, season 5 of Rescue Me won't appear on FX until next spring. But a box set of season 4 is coming out on DVD next week. On Rescue Me, Leary plays a fireman who is constantly risking his life to save the lives of strangers. But when he's off duty, he's constantly letting down his friends and family, and his personal life is out of control.
Are you still smoking? I know you're
I'm smoking right now.
Are you in the studio? They're letting you smoke in the New York studio. I shouldn't be
everywhere.
Saying this now. Everybody's going to want the privilege of smoking in there.
But I figured that there's been people on this show that probably did the same thing. I don't smoke anywhere near as much as I used to, and I'm actually getting ready to quit. But yeah,
Wait, you're getting ready to quit.
I am getting ready to quit.
What makes this a turning point? Because I think people have been on you for a long time to stop smoking for obvious reasons.
Well, especially my daughter.
Uh-huh.
But I'm almost 50, and I play a lot of ice hockey and a lot of street hockey. That's what I do to stay in shape. And I play with a lot of young guys, and I'm pretty fast for my age and able to handle myself, but I don't want to lose that step. But also, my daughter wants me to quit, and I'm at that age where I just think, okay, you know what? Let's try it without it and see what happens. You know what I mean? It's one of the things. 50 is a weird age, because even though I don't feel it, I look and I go, wow, man, I can't believe I made it this far, and I may have another 25 to go, so I better start thinking about what I want to do. You know what I mean?
Not used to looking ahead like that?
I'm not, actually. I've always been a sort of, you know, today type of guy. But now, you know, my kids are going to be up and out of the house soon and going to college, and, you know, I like my job a lot. But, you know, once I come out of it, when you're on a television show, it's kind of accepted. And I know it's true that people see you in that character for a while. So I'm going to have to disappear from television for a while and maybe do some movie parts or whatever. But there may be some downtime coming up where I have to just direct and write or whatever, or produce. And I'm trying to figure out. For Rescue Me, I have a stunt coming up where I have to drive a motorcycle with no helmet on. So I've started driving motocross to get ready for this stunt sequence, and I was afraid of it, but now I'm really in love with it. And I just started riding horses. I've had them for years, but I never rode them, and I just started riding horses last weekend, and all of a sudden these two things I always thought were too dangerous for me, I'm doing, and I'm going to be 50, and I'm like, you know what? Paul Newman's racing, you know, cars, and he's 82, so I got a lot of time. I might have another 30 years here, and I'm going to do some dangerous, crazy stuff. Now that, you know, I shouldn't be doing. I'm always, unfortunately, when people tell me not to do something, it's the first thing on my list to do. It started with the nuns telling us not to laugh and, you know, don't touch yourself. Well, you know, I tried both. I liked them.
Too late for that, huh?
Too late for that. And now, you know, it's certain you shouldn't be doing this at 50. Well, I'm going to try it. So riding that horse this weekend was just exhilarating. And this motocross was just exhilarating, you know?
So what's your plan for stopping smoking?
I have these fake cigarettes that they're made of plastic, and they give you a nicotine fix. So you're not getting the smoke, you're getting the nicotine, and then you wean yourself off. And I also have a hammer. I'm just going to hit myself in the side of the head with the hammer every time I want a cigarette. I figure that'll probably work. But then again, I'm Irish, so you never know.
Now, because there's a new baby in Tommy's family now, in your character's family now, and the baby is really colicking, he's crying all the time. This is a little further down, so I'm giving something away, but I think it's okay. Yeah. He takes a tip from a friend and is going to try putting some whiskey in the baby's bottle, just like a little drop, in the hopes that it quiets him down. Now, I've heard this before. Do you think that you were brought up that way?
Well, the old Irish thing was, and I'm not saying my wife and I didn't give our kids whiskey, but we were very hands-on with our kids. My wife was a fantastic mother. And my son was born very, very, very extremely premature. My wife actually wrote a terrific book about it called An Innocent Abroad. Instead of abroad being one word, it's a broad, meaning her. And it was, once he was through the tough times, we were very much of the mind, which was the way we were both raised, like put the kid on the floor and let the kid walk around. And all the things that fly around the floor, the kid will become immune to. People are so protective of their kids. Like, they're, it's like that old thing, how do they learn how to swim? Put them in the water and stand close to them. They'll figure it out and you'll save them if they have a problem. They're meant to bang their heads and fall down. And, there's a reason when a kid falls down that he looks at you first after he gets up, like, he doesn't know whether to cry or not. It's based on your reaction. If you panic, he'll panic. So when I was growing up, my mother tells us about it. They had dirt floors in the houses when they were growing up, and they crawled around, Basically, it's like puppies. The puppy's in the way. You don't just go like, oh, little baby puppies. You go, get the hell out of the way. Or let him try it and see if he gets hurt. He won't do it again. If the puppy touches the stove, he won't do it a second time. So I really believe in that kind of stuff. I think kids are too coddled in this country, and it's why we have so many fat kids now. It's just bad food and television.
You have two teenagers.
Although I'm not telling fat kids not to watch my show. If you're already fat and you're out there with a big bag of cheese puffs and you want to watch Rescue Me, by all means, stay on the couch. Don't leave the house unless your exercise should be to go to the store and buy the DVD of Rescue Me and then come home and sit down and watch that. Stay fat.
You have two teenage children. What is the most hypocritical thing that you're doing in terms of trying to regulate their behavior that you wholeheartedly engaged in when you were that age?
Yes, smoking bad, smoking not good, swearing, taking the Lord's name. I feel like I'm in the confessional now, Terry. Bless me, Terry, for I have sinned. I have taken the Lord's name in vain. I try to be, and my wife reminds me quite often, to be careful about, I think I've been good about getting over my rage. I don't fight taxi cab drivers anymore and try and try in traffic not to get into battles. And, I do have a black Irish temper, which I think I've come to control fairly well recently. And I think we try to be honest with our kids. I mean, we're very, in terms of our political beliefs and what we believe in to religiously, and family and stuff like that, we try to lead by example and make them, certain things are expected, like good manners, like in general. And I'm sure there are huge faults that I've just, big potholes I've left in the roads of my children's childhood. But they seem like really good kids. And I think that says a lot about my wife and hopefully me.
Dennis Leary speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2007 interview with actor, writer, producer Dennis Leary.
Has it been like oddly therapeutic to write your character of Tommy in Rescue Me, because he has so many of the extremes of the male ego that you've written about, and probably some of which you've had and probably some of which you've tried to like undo, but like by putting all of these extremes, like the fighting, the drinking, inability to have really enduring emotional relationships.
Yes.
So by putting that in him, can you stand back and say, I see what the problem is?
Well, it has helped me, definitely. It has helped me certainly in terms of grief. I lost so many people in such a short period of time, from the time my cousin was killed in that fire through 9/11, and then one of my best friends on the planet, Ted Demme, dropped dead January of 2002, right after 9/11. It helps in that regard. It does. What's good is that the two guys I said that I based the character on are like my same age, and I was talking to one of them this morning just about some very, very personal stuff, and the two of us were comparing notes on stupid things that we've done in relationships and talking about our kids and raising our kids. And the good thing is that at this age, we're starting to realize what idiots we have been and are potentially capable of being again. And I think that's a thing that I was never a part of my father's generation of men. Like, you got, you know, even me, I'm talking to this really tough, great New York City firefighter, and he's telling me things. It's like I'm talking to my shrink, and he's telling me things that I'm that are ringing bells in my head, and I'm going, you're right. We do need to be more emotionally available for the women in our lives and for our daughters and for our sons. And then I hear an alarm go off because he's at the firehouse. He's like, I'll call you back later. And he's going out on the call. So there's hope that we as men, that we will actually, I can't believe I'm 50 and just learning a lot of the stuff that I'm learning. I mean, I look back and I think, what a moron I was. I mean, what did I think?
Give me an example.
I'll give you an example. A year ago, I got into a fight with a cab driver. It was just ridiculous downtown, which ended up with nothing except him locking himself in the car and me trying to get in. And then me realizing that there are people with camera phones and that I've achieved nothing except if I wasn't in shape, I'd probably have a heart attack. And then I was late for work. So I drove away going, now what did I gain there? My face is red. My blood pressure is high. My heart's racing. I'm angry as hell. And all I've got is a bruise on my hand and nothing else. So that, I was 48 years old when that happened. So, you know, here I am, 49 years old. Wow, did I learn a great lesson? I learned not to beat up cab drivers. By the way, you know, living in New York or London or Rome, where are you not going to want to, you know, punch a cab driver? It just makes no sense, you know? So I hope that's true. And the same thing with, I said this last night about, you know, when people are photographing you and photographers, when you're famous, you know, I found that instead of throwing a can of beans like Hugh Grant did or kicking them or yelling or it makes no sense. It's actually better to just actually turn to them and say, you know, this is kind of ridiculous. Do you really need to keep taking pictures of me as I walk down? And they kind of get shamed and they go, you're right. I don't need these pictures of you. I mean, one of my favorite things to say is, I'm not Brad Pitt. Do you think you're photographing Brad Pitt? These pictures are worth nothing. It's Dennis Leary going to get a cup of coffee. I'm guaranteeing you. Call Wire Images. It's worth 25 cents. And it seems to work. So, you know.
What was the fight with the taxi cab driver about?
All right. So now you want to get to the core of the male ego?
Yes.
I'm on my way to work. I'm driving. It's early, early in the morning. I'm driving to the set of Rescue Me. And, you know, this is why they really don't allow me to drive myself to work anymore, by the way. I'm driving myself to work, and there's nothing but green lights in front of us because there's no traffic. It's like, you know, it's 5:45 or something in the morning. And he's strolling along at like 10 miles an hour. He's looking to find a fare. And I beep the horn because we got four green lights in front of us. And he short brakes me. He puts the brake on, and I just miss hitting his back end. Then he speeds up to the next, it's still a green light, the next block, and I come up behind him, and he short brakes me again. So I squeal to a stop, and he goes a third time. Well, the third time, I'm not proud to say it, but it was, I think, any jury of my peers would be on my side. You know, like 12 Dennis Learys. I hit him, I tapped him from behind, and of course we both got out, and he started screaming, and half English, half Pakistani, because he's not an American citizen. That's why I started. I was like, get your license and registration. That's when he panicked, because he didn't have one, because he's not a citizen of this country. So he locks himself in the cab, and I'm ranting and raving, and holding up my wallet and my license and registration, you know, wearing a 62 truck Rescue Me t-shirt. You know, could I have more of an advertisement? Like, I wonder who that is. So, and it went on for like 15, 20 minutes. And I gained, I probably lost, you know, a few calories. But that was it. I got to work. I was pissed off. It made no sense.
That's a long time, 15 to 20 minutes.
I know. Out of my life.
All the traffic you were holding up while you were doing it, too.
Yeah. And, you know, here I am sometimes in a bad movie going like, I can't believe they wasted 2 hours of my life. You know, it makes no sense. It's stupid. It's stupid. It's so stupid. And by the way, thank God my kids weren't with me so they could see how what an example their dad is for yelling and screaming at a guy who can't even understand English, you know. But I was in the right. See, there's the male ego part. I was right because there were green lights and he was – it's stupid.
Well, Dennis, Dennis Leary, I wish you good luck in being mature. And it was great to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Bye.
Dennis Leary, speaking to Terry Gross in 2007. The fourth season of Rescue Me comes out on DVD next week. When jazz saxophonist James Carter came along in the late 1980s, he was so obviously talented and so versatile, he was hired by two trumpeters who agreed about little else, Wynton Marsalis and Lester Bowie. Then came Carter's knockout solo release, JC on the Set, so good it was hard to top. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Carter's new CD shows he's still got the gift.
James Carter has always been something of a hot dog and a boaster. He radiates a joyful exhibitionism more common to top trumpeters than saxophones. Carter doesn't just play one horn well enough to make your ears pop. He made his initial rep as a tenor saxophonist, but these days he's even more acclaimed for his baritone. Fair enough. With a bigger horn, he can crank it up even more. Some folks gripe James Carter goes too far, that he clubs you over the head with his power chops. Carter's flashy, but he's not shallow. His bag of saxophone tricks pulls in influences from vaudeville novelties to the avant-garde. And he learned a lot from swing and bebop masters about how to shape a statement and navigate through fast-moving chord changes. This music's from James Carter's new album, Present Tense, a good showcase for his prodigious talents, abetted by guitarist Rodney Jones, trumpeter Dwight Adams, pianist Dede Jackson, and bass and drum champs James Genus and Victor Lewis. Not content to blow you away on tenor and baritone, Carter also plays soprano sax, not too whiny, and sweet bass clarinet, as on this salute to 60s hero Eric Dolphy. Even there, Carter eventually erupts from tender balladeer into fire breather. He also plays flute, a tricky instrument for the non-specialist. But here again, he hits the mark, avoids that faint, insubstantial tone part-time flutists often get. Flute also allows for a frothy change of pace, Dodo's Bounce by bebop pianist Dodo Marmarosa. On his CD Present Tense, James Carter switches up styles, too. There are ballads, blues, a bossa nova, and a hip-hop-inflected version of 1949's Song of Delilah. Some musicians make albums where they check off different styles to verify their jazz credentials. With Carter, it's about his voracious appetites as a player and a listener. He wants to devour it all.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed Present Tense, the new CD by James Carter. In 1998, the series Sex and the City premiered on HBO with a script by creator Darren Star based on a book by Candace Bushnell. For 94 episodes through 2004, the series was a hit and a star turn for Sarah Jessica Parker. Now there's a movie, and we get to see how the four gal pals at the center of the series have aged and changed. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
A much-anticipated movie is opening this week, and oh boy, and oh girl, what a rush. Because instead of comic book fan geeks fighting for tickets, there are women lining up in awesome numbers. It's Sex and the City, the motion picture. If you love the TV show, it's a joyous 2.5-hour wallow. If you hate it, think Chinese water torture. Now, I love the show, but I hated it once, so I see both sides. They can be very annoying, these overprivileged, materialistic women who depend on men for their self-esteem while also treating them as objects. On the other hand, what a hoot to watch women for once doing the objectifying and talking dirty, sleeping around, and wearing fabulous clothes. The movie opens 3 years after the series, and in case you missed the finale, or the show, newspaper relationships columnist Carrie Bradshaw, played by Sarah Jessica Parker, brings you up to date over the credits. Miranda, Cynthia Nixon, lives in Brooklyn, which here means Siberia, with her kid and mousy husband. Charlotte, Kristen Davis, and her hubby have adopted a Chinese girl, now a toddler, whose presence makes it hard to babble with her friends about sex. Samantha, Kim Cattrall, is wilting from monogamy with her hunk-a-burnin' Hollywood lover boy. Carrie has finally settled into the arms of Chris Noth's Mr. Big and can afford even more shoes. But Miranda wonders whether the new, shared penthouse apartment comes with a hidden price.
So you're keeping your own place, right?
Miranda, I haven't figured out the details yet, but I'm a smart girl, and I'm sure I'll figure out something that I'm very comfortable with.
I just want to be sure that you're being smart here.
And I love you for that, but for now, can't you stop worrying for me and just go ahead and feel what I want you to feel? Jealous. Oh, jealous of me living in this gorgeous penthouse in Manhattan.
All right, I'm jealous.
Oh, thanks.
You live in real estate heaven, and I live in Brooklyn. New York Magazine said Brooklyn is the new Manhattan.
Oh,
whoever wrote that lives in Brooklyn.
I won't spoil what happens, but the wedding of Carrie and Big midway through is a heartstopper, a farce without mirth, where cell phones and limos function as agents of the unconscious. Parker is spectacular. She's come in for monstrous derision lately, maybe inevitable, given how she's pushed on billboards as the personification of sultriness. But on screen, you can see the fragility beneath the poses. She's a little girl dressing up, wriggling from one eye-popping outfit to the next, elated, but likely to wither in the face of rejection or self-doubt. Of course, the heart of Sex and the City is not any one character, but all four together. And it's possible the friendship is the biggest romantic fantasy of all. They complement one another perfectly. They're never too competitive. But what an inspiring fantasy it is, an haute couture designed for living. If Cattrall's high-style vulgarity borders on camp, it doesn't drown out her down-to-earth moments of pain. Nixon makes Miranda's prickly ambivalence so real it's wrenching. And her bitterness over the sacrifices she made for her marriage is the movie's bleak subplot. The balance between dark and light tips to the dark, which makes Kristen Davis's old-fashioned ditzy double takes all the more welcome. The movie was written and directed by Michael Patrick King, an executive producer and writer on the show, and the hetero men are lesser entities, and the product placements irritating. The pacing sags in the last half hour. But when you're this invested, it barely matters. This is what the show's finale should have been, the ultimate exploration, as these women settle edgily into their 40s, of independence versus commitment, the fairy tale trappings of modern romance smashing against a sobering reality, which is where those pink cocktails come in. I hazarded to a friend that Sex and the City theater lines would be great places to meet babes, and she said, "Not so fast, Slobberpuss. There's going to be serious female bonding there." She's probably right. I'd be much less cowed by overweight teenage boys with plastic lightsabers than roving bands of cosmo-pickled women finally getting their day in the multiplex.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.